uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Gentlemen, welcome to another live edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. This is the Monday edition of the broadcast, June 11th, 2012, into Tuesday, June 12th, 2012. Thanks for being with us tonight. Almost no show tonight, and so I kept kind of delaying it. Could have delayed it another 15 minutes, actually, but... normally Mondays are always, you know, jam packed for us. And there's always a lot of stuff to talk about, but, we really only have a handful of news stories here tonight. And so, we'll get through those and then we'll just, continue on our reading. It got real interesting last week. If you didn't hear those shows in our series of reading last week, we, got into some more stuff about the Servant Mound in Ohio and these different mounds in, other locations as well, and just more and more information tying into its connections. Absolute, no doubt that the Rock Wall and Enigma and the Serpent Mound Enigma are intimately connected and were very likely built by the same people. And it's just fascinating stuff. So definitely go back and re-listen to that if you didn't hear those shows last week in the archives. My website where this broadcast originates from is theglobalreality.com. That's theglobalreality.com. Everything pertaining to everything you'd want to find for our work is up there, from the films to past radio shows, archives, chat room, everything's up there. Theglobalreality.com. If you want to send an email to me during the show or anytime, you have questions, comments, anything else, Global Reality Show. @gmail.com. That's Global Reality Show @gmail.com. I went and saw the film Prometheus this weekend. I got to say, I was pretty let down by it. I just think Ridley Scott is a fucking terrible director. He's one of those things, you know how people convince themselves that a band is really good, a lot better than they really are, and you can't, no matter how what it is, you can't talk them out of it. People like Radiohead. You know what I mean? Nothing against Radiohead, I like them too, but you know what I'm talking about, though. There's that specific type of person that just, you know, Tom York could fart in a microphone for 2 hours and it would just be fucking pure poetry to him. I think a lot of us have probably convinced ourselves really Scott's a good director. Man, the guy can't progress a story for shit. Think about it. I mean, even the first Alien movie that he directed was the worst one of the series, really. I mean, it had the, you know, the chest bursting part and stuff like that, and that was the, you know, those the highlights, but the second film that was directed by James Cameron, I think, would arguably be the best. I would say it would be the best of the series. Maybe that's what they need to do here with Prometheus, is do what they did the first go around, bring Cameron in again to do the sequel, because, just like predicted, I mean, as soon as I heard they were making an Aliens prequel, I knew immediately it was going to have an Ancient Aliens tie-in. And of course it did, with, you know, alien human DNA, all that stuff. But even the people that you see, there's more questions than answers in this movie. And even the people that you do see that appear to be these giants are not by any means the top of the food chain. And so the movie sort of ends with, you know, the main character going out to find who these other people are. So they've definitely set the thing. There would be the table. There will be a sequel, but I don't know, man. I thought it was just poorly directed. The acting wasn't bad. The acting wasn't bad or anything. And this, you know, it did serve the story of the alien stuff. It was, you know, right along the same lines as all the Alien versus Predator movies and all the Alien movies. You know, Wayland Corporation is always there. And, you know, much like in our regular real world, you know, anything that they come across is always their interest is to make a weapon out of it. And so that's definitely there in the storyline again. But the actions are not really. There's not really a lot of action. There's not really anything new. The use of the 3D IMAX was completely pointless, if you ask me. Nothing jumped out of the screen at you. You know, like Tron, you know, the disc is like flying towards your face. And there was a lot of areas in this film where they could have had, you know, stuff jumping out of the screen at you or anything like that. It was just poorly used. And I thought really kind of a, because what they call it now is a premium experience. That's what they call that. So the premium experience is what allows them to be able to command a $17, you know, movie ticket. And I got to be honest with you, I don't think that their use of the 3D IMAX for Prometheus justified the extra, you know, bump up in ticket price, because it didn't make the movie better. You know what I mean? It should have. If they would have enhanced the 3D IMAX experience and made more stuff pop out at you, focused more on more action, things like that, it would have kept people's attention more, and they would have overlooked the shortcomings that I'm pointing out. But that was impossible because they, you know, not only did they progress the story for shit, and they didn't make you in any way, shape, or form interested in the characters at all. I personally think, honestly, that it was intended to be that way. I think that, I mean, I thought this as soon as I was watching it. I think that 100% what this is it's a vehicle. It's a vehicle for them to do what we've been saying for the past few years they've been doing with Ancient Aliens. It's a vehicle to roll out the, you know, the idea that, you know, actually we may have come from extraterrestrials. And it does worry me a bit. It's worried me for a long time, considering that sort of the epicenter of bringing this to light and the gatekeepers and bringing it to the mainstream consciousness were people like Eric Von Daniken, who is a Jesuit. I have a recording of him from Coast to Coast AM where he admits he's a Jesuit. Right at the very beginning. Tell us about yourself there, Mr. Von Daniken. Well, I was trained by these Jesuits. Straight out of the fucking gates. And so by that alone, anything that he says or has said about any of this stuff should be held as being suspect. And I think with that connection, there is a definite possibility that a lot of this Ancient Alien stuff now is being gatekeeped and allowed to be brought out in a controlled way in order for them to, I think just this sets a perfect stage for one world religious system. That's what worries me the most about, is that they're going to, once again, they're going to try to, because look, they've been exposed quite a bit and continue to be with the questions that the Sumerian texts bring up from people who have half a brain for themselves to think for themselves, to look at it and read and see what it says. And I think it's caused a lot of problems. You know, people no longer have faith in anything as far as any sort of establishments go anymore. You know what I mean? That's been lost and gone. So something needs to come back and vilify those establishments. And I think the rolling out of the DNA thing. Well, look, I'm just gonna shoot right to it, because this is in the stack tonight. And as soon as I saw this, you know, just right after this weekend seeing Prometheus and the fact that they tie in it with the movie here, why aliens might look like you. DNA could be a universal constant, making humans and ET closer to cousins. Now, isn't that interesting? And it's funny because, you know, I don't necessarily think that I don't necessarily think that's true. In fact, when you look at some of these ancient depictions of the Anunnaki, they vary, and that's where a lot of this stuff from shapeshifters and stuff comes from. It's because the depiction of these guys varies. Sometimes they're in sometimes they look like humans, but very tall, very large, beards, long flowing hair. And other times they look like winged creatures, bird-type creatures. And remember, birds are avian reptiles. That's the technical term for birds. That's where they come from. And I think what you see there is you see a lot of evidence for what has been described as shapeshifters and the fact that this is a dormant in DNA, just like anything else that's dormant. And in some people, more predominantly, especially in the bloodline families, this trait sometimes comes out. So there's definitely an agenda here that they're trying to tie gods or aliens. I'm sorry, I said the wrong way. Trying to tie aliens and humans together and saying they look together much in the same way in the past. They've tried to tie gods together as looking very much like humans as well. To anyone who has seen the film Prometheus, it is a very familiar story. Humans and aliens may share the same DNA, which could be a part of a universal structure, according to researchers. The building blocks of life exist in low temperatures and low pressure, meaning they are far more likely to flourish if they were more complex. While no concrete proof has yet been found, the finding makes it more likely they would develop on strange planets than had been previously been thought. The theory was put forward by Ralph Purdiritz of McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, who built on existing research into amino acids. In total, there are 20 standard such chemicals which contain the DNA from which human life is developed. Researchers have already synthesized the 10 which are thought to have existed millions of years ago and also discovered these are most likely to be found on meteorites, too. Purdiritz has concluded that these 10 are simpler, need less heat and lower pressure than more complex acids, meaning they are more likely to survive in hostile environments. And while the exact conditions of meteorites are not known, they are thought to be warm and hydrated, which would make comparable conditions to a young Earth. Purdiritz said that this may implicate a universal structure of the first genetic codes anywhere. There's a theory that they could be made in the warm interiors of a large enough meteorite. Thermodynamics is fundamental. It must hold through all points of the universe. If you can show there are certain frequencies that fall in a natural way like this, there is an implied universality. It has to be tested, but it seems to make a lot of sense. In Prometheus, an alien race landed on Earth millions of years ago, but they decided to create human life. In the opening sequence, a human-like creature is seen drinking a black fluid before falling into a stream where the first creature suddenly springs to life. Harvard University systems biologist Irene Chin. Well, yeah, no spoilers. If you haven't seen the movie, you don't want to listen to this. But yeah, I didn't realize. See, that tells me more about the movie. See, I didn't understand that was actually on Earth. I thought it was supposed to be on another planet. But I thought it was interesting because at the beginning of the movie, you see this giant. You know, it's a giant white skinned person. You know, that looked to me like the description of. They really seemed to me like they were the Agigi, the worker bees. Because they were on this other planet doing this work, which is where the first alien movie takes place. You know, they hear the homing beacon, they go to this planet. Well, that planet is where these workers were, creating the alien, so to speak. But it's interesting because at the beginning of the film, yeah, you see this white, big white giant guy standing there. And there's this like teardrop-shaped UFO. And it looks identical to some UFOs that have actually been seen and reported. And it's kind of flying over and kind of hovering, and it drops this, like, capsule with these weird hieroglyphs, weird writing on it, and it's, like, bubbling up, and this thing drink, this white guy drinks it for some reason. I mean, is that what you do? Well, you know, spaceship drop things. I mean, it was like oozing. It looked, you know, didn't look tasty. So he downs it and like rips him apart and he falls into the stream and like his parts decimate. And then it's supposed, I guess, every life, all of life evolved after that from that. Almost like a virus. And, I, you know, people have made the argument the humans are a virus. Yeah, so. They're definitely getting ready to roll this stuff out. And by bringing everybody into a one-world religious system through the disclosure of knowledge of ancient extraterrestrials, it would play right into the hands of them setting up their one-world power structure. So, you better bet, you know, that's why I have a vested interest in covering this this type of stuff well as well and getting into it. Is, and that's why I've gotten into it for this long. Now, some people choose not to get into this stuff, but I've said for the longest time, the reason you need to be informed about this Anunnaki stuff and all this other, you know, this stuff that people think is distractions, because let's talk about Jews and bankers instead. What they haven't understood about that is that this has been one of their plans for the longest time to use this as one of the main means of bringing in a one-world power structure. And so if they are indeed going to roll this out, and there are indicators that it seems they are, we need to be very knowledgeable about this stuff so we can call out the bullshit. You know what I mean? We can call out the lies whenever we see them. So that's a very interesting story there. I'll try to slide over here. And put this link in there for you. Yeah, the guy looked mad when they woke him up. Well, yeah, because he was supposed to be hibernating for a period of time. Those were definitely workers because at the end she's, you know, she says she's going back because they actually came from another planetary system. So there's going to be some, I think in the sequels, you're probably going to see who these real deal guys were. Anyway, there you go. There's the story. It'd be great, though, if sometimes y'all could just Google search these articles when I call them out. It's kind of a pain to have to go in there and drop them in the chat room every time, but people bitch if I don't, so. They bitch about everything I do anyway, so it's new, right? Well, this is just wonderful here from the Bill and Melinda Gates' wonderful world of eugenics. Why don't they just start their own theme park and get it over with? I mean, Disney is almost there. I mean, they have rides sponsored by Monsanto and shit. But this is just astounding. And it even says that here. This is from the Washington Post. In the you can't make this up stuff category, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is spending about $1.1 million to develop a way to physiologically measure how engaged students are by their teachers' lessons. This involves galvanic skin response bracelets that kids would wear so their engagement levels could be measured. Boy, that's just what we need, isn't it? Bill and Melinda Gates, oh, they love the kids so much. So we're going to see if we can gauge now who is the most responsive and engaged in the government training camp programming. That way, the kids who are, you know, trying to break through the programming, not paying attention and listen to it and just do what they need to do to get by because they know it's bullshit, are going to be weeded out easier because they're going to have a scientific method of making these kids wear a bracelet. They can just determine, oh, well, little Johnny, he wasn't paying attention in class today. How do you know? I was looking at the teacher and looking like I was paying attention the whole time. Oh, well, we have the galvanic skin reading, see? And, of course, this data could be manipulated anyway. You don't know what they're going to do. They could manipulate this data and bring you in and say, little Johnny, he wasn't paying attention, and maybe he was paying attention, but maybe little Johnny is special, and maybe he's got things they see as a threat, so they want to put him on SSRIs and all this other stuff. Like, my God, I mean, they've already been exposed for being involved in eugenics, and I think he was Bill Gates, I think, was seen at Bilderberg this year as well. $1.1 million for grants for galvanic skin bracelets that engage students' engagement. So, you know, the good old days are over, kids. Good old days of just skating by and not having to listen to the teacher over. No, they're going to make sure they got your ass on lockdown now. Scientists say diamonds could be the secret to mind-bogglingly fast quantum computers. A turbocharged computer. Now, this is interesting. Zircon being one of the main components of the rock wall as well. We talked about the servant mount stuff last week. Very, very interesting stuff here. A turbocharged computer that could change the world forever is a major step closer after scientists worked out how to store memory using quantum physics. Two separate teams of researchers have figured out how quantum information called qubits can be stored using either diamond crystals or pure silicon. Well, that's old technology, Bubba. I got a Lemurian seed crystal right here on my desk. Bang it. Guess what? That motherfucker does the same thing. It's got information encoded in it, dude. You can see it. It's got little ridges down the side of it, like where it's encoded like data. Yeah, they've known how to do that for a long time. We're just now figuring it out, though. Scientists are trying to build a quantum computer that could complete in mere minutes the calculations that would take the best supercomputers years. Quantum computers would harness a mysterious property of subatomic particles that allows them to exist in two different places at once when trapped. Very small-scale quantum computers already exist in control conditions in laboratories, but scientists have not been able to find a way to get them to exist in a real-world environment. Now scientists have pushed the limit of how long information can be stored in solid state outside a vacuum. One team created a device based on ultra-pure silicone that could store data for more than 3 minutes so long as it was cooled below minus 275 degrees Celsius. The other team used a diamond crystal and achieved a store time of 1.4 seconds at room temperature. The findings are reported in two papers in Science magazine. It's by far a record in solid-state systems, said physicist Mike Thiewalt of Simon Fraser University, Canada, who worked with colleagues at Oxford University and in Berlin on the silicone-based system. If you'd asked people a few years ago if this was possible, they'd have said no. It opens up new ways of using solid-state semiconductors, such as silicone, as a base for quantum computing. And, yeah, I mean, that's... Again, that's not anything that we're just new. That we're just finding it out ourselves, though. Very interesting stuff here. And I think people have speculated this may be the sign that 12-strand DNA activation is indeed happening right now. A lot of people believe it is happening. A 2-year-old boy has become the only person in the world to be diagnosed with an extra strand of DNA. Brave Alfie Clamp was born blind and with severe disabilities, which led doctors to carry out various tests. They revealed his 7th chromosome had an extra strand of material which has never been documented anywhere in the world before. Doctors are baffled at his condition, which is so rare it does not have a name. Medics also have no idea whether his condition will improve or reduce his life expectancy. Alfie from Newington Works can now see, and he will have an operation this month to fix an intestinal problem caused by his condition. Man, he's a cutie. But literally, his chromosomes have an extra arm. So, man, oh man, that's wild stuff right there. Very well could be happening. A renowned scientist has said he spotted evidence that a universe existed before the Big Bang. Now, you know, I got to tell you, a few years ago, I was almost laughed off the air because I started talking about the possibility that either the Anunnaki or someone that came before them terraformed this planet, and some of these great cataclysms we've had in the past have been a result of someone re-terraforming this planet for their own means, their own devices, possibly even during the, possibly that's what wiped out the dinosaurs, I've speculated, you know. And it's funny how much more information seems to validate that, especially things like this, the discoveries they found on Mars. There appears to be some terraforming going on there. And you start to see this popping up in movies. I've seen it popping up in movies a lot lately, terraforming. It's been popping up everywhere a little bit. They talk about it in Prometheus as well. But it does make you wonder if not only our planet, but maybe, as it says here in this article, our entire universe. You know, somebody somewhere, whoever it may be, the creator of all things, who knows. But more and more evidence does seem to come to light that somebody's got a reset button. And that periodically, even though periodically in terms of, you know, our universe is, you know, quadrillion, trillion, gazillion of years, but it does seem that, you know, there's a reset button happen. So now they're finding evidence that that like a ghost image of a universe that existed before the Big Bang. Professor Roger Penrose from Oxford University says concentric circles discovered in the background microwaves of the universe provides evidence of events that took place before the universe came into being. Cricket, chirp, chirp, chirp. Science, how about you? Chirp, chirp, chirp. Religion, how about you? We got nothing. Chirp, chirp. Yeah, see, yeah, this is going to fuck them all up, isn't it? The cosmic microwave offers us a ghostly look at the universe just 300,000 years after the Big Bang. A microscopic amount of time compared to the universe's estimated age of 13.7 billion years. The research by Penrose, who was awarded the 1988 Wolf Prize along with Stephen Hawking for adding to our cosmic knowledge, adds evidence to the theory that the universe has expanded and contracted many times. The cosmic radiation background is believed to have cooled to a temperature of negative 270 degrees Celsius in the near 14 billion years since the birth of the universe. Stars and galaxies started to form around 300 million years later. Our sun was born around 5 billion years ago, and life first appeared on the Earth around 3.7 billion years ago. The Daily Galaxy reports that Professor Penrose, along with Professor Vahe Gudazan of the Yverevan State University in Armenia, believes images of the CMB from NASA's Wilkinson microwave probe shows imprints in the radiation that are older than the Big Bang. They say they have discovered 12 examples of concentric circles, some of which have five rings, which means the same object had five massive events in its history. The rings appear around galaxy clusters in which the variation in the background radiation appears to be strangely low. The research appears to cast aside the widely held inflationary theory of the origins of the universe that it began with a Big Bang and will continue to expand until a point in the future when it will end. They believe the circles are imprints of extremely violent gravitational radiation waves generated by supermassive black hole collisions in a previous aeon before the last Big Bang. They say that this means that the universe cycles through aeons dominated by Big Bangs and supermassive black hole collisions. Professor Penrose believes that this new theory of conformal cyclic cosmology means that black holes will eventually consume all matter in the universe. According to this theory, when they have finished, all that will be left in the universe will be energy, which will then trigger the next Big Bang and the new aeon. Professor Penrose told the BBC, in a scheme that I'm proposing, you have an exponential expansion, but it's not in our aeon. I use the term to describe the period from our Big Bang until the remote future. Very, very interesting stuff there. Well, the guy in Georgia that there was a lot of contention about, a lot of people said it was bullshit because he, you know, was in the Examiner or whatever. Well, I did some researching into it myself, and I was going to go there on my trip, but of course, we weren't able to do it, and I was hoping to maybe take a trip back and be able to go there. Maybe something will happen, and we'll get lucky, and somebody will want to help us out with some funding for the new film, but at least so we can do another, you know, another round of shooting and traveling. But, yeah, it seems that this guy's back in the news again with the Mayan stuff in Georgia. Is this the lost Mayan city of Yupaha? Historian creates a 3D image of a 1,000-year-old civilization in the Georgia mountains. The Mayans built astonishing temples in Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras, but now some believe the ancient peoples fled their dissolving civilizations and ended up in Georgia. Historian and architect Richard Thornton believes a 1,100-year-old archaeological site shows that Mayan refugees fled Central America and ended up in the North Georgian mountains near Blairsville. His astonishing theory is based on the discovery of 300 to 500 rock terraces and mounds on the side of Brasstown Bald Mountain that date to 900 AD, around the time when the Mayans began to die out. Mr. Thornton's blockbuster theory revolves around the area near Brasstown Bald, potentially being the fabled city of Yupaha, which Spanish explorer Hernando de Soto failed to find in 1540. And, you know, I've seen the area where this is around, and there are mounds near this thing. And that's why I think all this stuff about this being Mayan and all this, I think this is a red herring. I don't doubt there's something there. I mean, other people have been contending before when the last article came out a few months ago that this was even there at all or even real at all. I don't doubt that there's something there. But I've seen pictures of the area, and there's an area that's in wooded trees. It's on a guy's property, and it looks, it's a mound. It's a big, giant mound with big trees, you know, that have been there for a while coming out of it. And, you know, the Mayans were not associated with building mounds like that, not at any time. So, as usual, I think it's much older than what they're telling it is, and I think this guy is, you know, yet again another gatekeeper, as we generally always see anytime anybody finds any kind of archaeological thing, and that's where I'm trying to come in at, you know, to kick down the walls of the gatekeepers. Council for National Policy member and Knight of Malta, Oliver North, has become embroiled in a plagiarism controversy after writing a column featuring a direct passage from a Vietnam War veteran's memoir. Oh, Ollie, you silly motherfucker. One of the key moments in Cigarette Volume 1, if you haven't seen it, is parting there from a news clip I have where they said that they've, in Oliver North's safe, I never heard hide nor hair of this before that, but it's in there that they found a plan inside Oliver North's safe to blame Iran-Contra on Israel if they needed to. And they just blow by that in this news story, just like, it's, oh, yeah, they found a plan to, in Oliver North's safe, to blame Iran-Contra on Israel if needed. You know, for the nightly news, I'm Sam Walton, or whatever the fuck his name is, you know. I just thought, well, wow, that's, you know, that's pretty huge. Because here's Ollie North, Knights of Malta. Of course, that's why he's not brought to justice for any of his crimes, and why he gets off scot-free and able to operate, because he's working for them. And lo and behold, here's our little bitch boys, Israel. Well, fucking, we'll just blame it on them if we need to, right? Who's going to question that? Cocksucker. This is strange. I can't really find anything that says what kind of shaman these were. Just kind of a strange article. Two shaman were cut, shot, and killed. A gunman shot and killed two men and a woman at their home and also died after someone returned fire. Two of the victims were described as shamans, spiritual elders in the Hmong community. A fifth person was wounded in a critical condition after the attack on Saturday night. Police were searching for a motive after an assailant entered the home in Sacramento, California. Officers who responded to reports of gunfire found three men and one woman dead, Police spokeswoman Officer Michelle Giganti said one of the dead, determined to be a suspect, was shot by someone inside the house who had confronted him. Investigators were unsure if there were any additional suspects. And it just shows, I guess they're Asian of some kind, but still, just the whole shaman tie-in thing, probably. I mean, to be honest with you, dude, I mean, if these guys were shaman and there was a bunch of people shot up dead, this is a drug deal gone wrong, you ask me. Probably bath salts again, you know. Who knows? But yeah, you know, shaman, that means, shaman in the modern day context means you give somebody hallucinogenic drugs like DMT or ayahuasca or mushrooms or something like that, and they trip out, and you call yourself a shaman and take them on guiding trips, you know. This is convenient. Talk about convenient, you know, especially with all the research that's proven for years and years that there is most definitely a link between mercury and autism. Convenient, though, for the pharmaceutical companies here. A freezer malfunction at Harvard-affiliated McLean Hospital has severely damaged one-third of the world's largest collection of autism brain samples, potentially setting back research on the disorder by years, scientists say. Right, that's all just an accident. Autism is a bioweapon. It's there, but that Merck and the rest of these pharmaceutical companies put it there with this form of this mercury container. And it's there for I think, for to switch off for good certain people who were born with a certain extra light. I mean, it's unbelievable. You're going to tell me this is all just an accident. An official at the renowned Brain Bank in Belmont discovered that the freezer had shut down in late May without triggering two alarms. Inside, they found 150 thawed brains that had turned dark from decay, and about a third of them were part of a collection of autism brains. This was a priceless collection, said Dr. Francine Beans, director of the Harvard Brain Tissue Resource Center, where the brains were housed. You can't express its value in dollar amounts. And this is perfect. This is a boon for the pharmaceutical. And now it'll be a lot more years until people are able to trace this back directly to the pharmaceutical companies, which we already know it has. But see, this is the smoking gun here. So conveniently, the evidence of the smoking gun that connects autism to the pharmaceutical companies, well, guess what? Well, damage destroyed. It's going to set the research back years. All just a coincidence. All just an accident. There's plausible deniability out the wazoo. Nobody to blame. And just conveniently for them, they're going to have the whole world locked down in worldwide national health care, and they'll have everybody as a client by law by the time the research gets done now, and then it'll be too late. That's just great news. Well, I've been saving this one back, and I can't wait any longer. Allegedly, they are saying that they have possibly found the famed Ciudad Blanca, the White City of Gold, which is purported to be the birthplace of none other than our good friend and pal, the feathered serpent, Quetzalcoatl. And I tell you what, I want me some of this. I needs to get me some of this. I need some of this for the rock wall. I'll tell you what, this new advanced laser mapping technique they're using to do this. Oh my goodness, man. Golly, I need to get my hands on some of this something awful. A team of scientists using advanced laser mapping have detailed a remote region of Honduras that may have revealed the legendary lost city of Ciudad Blanca, known as the White City of Gold. Research from the University of Houston and the National Center for Airborne Laser Mapping flew over the Mosquito region in a small plane, shooting billions of laser pulses at the ground to create a 3D digital map of the topology beneath the jungle canopy. Compiling their data, the analysts revealed what appeared to be man-made elevation changes that are thought to show a forgotten city plaza dotted with pyramids reclaimed by the jungle. According to legend, Ciudad Blanca, or the White City, is full of gold and has been sought out by explorers and treasure hunters since conquistador Hernando Cortes first made reference to it in a 1526 letter to King Charles V of Spain. Inspired by this legend, cinematographer and Ciudad Blanca enthusiast Stephen Elkins sought backing from private investors. That's what I'm looking for. I'm seeking the backing of private investors to pay for the team and Inclam to use their laser mapping technology to chart the flora of Mosquito. So I got to have private backers to get this team of Inclam or whatever they are to do this. Well, they're University of Houston. I'm from Texas. I don't know. Maybe they'll cut me a deal or something. Yeah, only $100 million for you, Mr. Reeves. Ain't got that. Ain't going to have that. Sorry. I'm sure it's not that much. Over the course of a week, the Inclam and University of Houston engineers flew over 60 square miles of forest in their dual-engine Cessna planes. At the end of each day, the data was transferred to Bill Carter, a University of Houston engineer who works with Inclam. He discovered the first indications of what appeared to be man-made structures in the jungle. I'm the only person right now on the planet that knows that there's these ruins, said Carter as he recalled his thoughts when he saw straight lines and right angles on the 3D digital map. My wife walked in and looked over my shoulder, and she was the second person to know. This was one of the first times that laser mapping, specifically light detection and ranging, LIDAR, has been used to locate ancient ruins. Well, then I need to be the second. The rock wall. The original uses of the technology were to provide intelligence after earthquakes, military spying, and for river erosion detection. Flying over the intended target area, LIDAR operates by sending out 100,000 short laser pulses to the ground each second. The University of Houston and the Inclam team blanket the Mosquito Rainforest with as many as 25 to 50 laser pulses every square meter that totaled up as more than 4 billion shots during the entire project. Like the high-tech version of sonar, the light beams hit the ground and return to the aircraft, and the time taken allows researchers to create a 3D digital map of the surrounding topology. Able to differentiate between differences in height of less than 4 inches, the University of Houston has worked with the Inclam to develop their LIDAR systems. Ciudad Blanca has played a central role in the Central American mythology. Texts cite it as the birthplace of the Aztec god Quetzalcoatl, and previous reported sightings over the years have described golden idols and elaborately carved white stones leading to the lost city's name. However, no confirmation of the existence of the city has ever been provided. If confirmed, the discovery of Ciudad Blanca could be comparable to the popularization of forgotten sites such as Machu Picchu, which lay ruined for hundreds of years until reintroduced to Western eyes in 1911 by American historian Hiram Bingham. And if the myth is dispelled, any positive identification of the fabled white city of Ciudad Blanca would reignite hopes of finding the legendary lost city of gold, El Dorado. While the news of the encouraging results this week were greeted favorably by Honduran President Porfirio Lobo, archaeologists will now have to undertake a trek through the dense forest to visit the site in person. Oh, how terrible. How terrible that must be. I'll fucking go. Send me. You're going to bitch about it. I'll go. Oh, how terrible. I have to go all the way through the jungle to go some ancient sign. I'll do that shit. Let's go. Anyway, like I told you, not a lot of news tonight. That's it. That's going to do it for the news. Hopefully there'll be more tomorrow. We'll have more of a show, but that's why I was on, when some people were coming in the chat room, wondering if there's going to be a show, and I was like, yeah, almost not, but did it anyway. But anyway, we're going to take a break, come back, and get into our series of reading for you here tonight. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. That's TheGlobalReality.com. And this is The Global Reality on the Global Reality Radio Network. Stay with us.
uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
All right, back here with you. Oops. Always forget to hit that damn button as it starts feeding back in my headset. Welcome back. This is the Global Reality. Ooh, it's coughing there. I did that drink down the wrong pipe thing. Ugh, happened a lot lately. Whew. Come on, iPad, turn on. Sorry about that. Apologize. Woo. And my composure here. Coming back. Waiting for the iPad to boot up. Thanks for being with us here tonight for another late night move out edition of the broadcast. We're going to be getting into our continued series of reading here for you tonight on the show. Been pretty interesting lately, so I think it'll probably continue to be that way. Tonight, chapter 18, A Templar Tower in Rhode Island. I had to fight the urge to research this over the weekend. I was just so intrigued by, I'd never heard of this, so this is probably going to end up being something else I need to go find, huh? A Templar Tower in Rhode Island, chapter 18, from the Lost Worlds of Ancient America. That's going to be what we're getting into here tonight. Again, at my website, theglobalreality.com, you have all the ways up there to support our work. Chip in banner for the operating costs. Chip in banner for an emergency fundraiser for the film. And we also have the donate button. You can put any amount up to $10,000 a day in there. We also have P.O. Box. We absolutely can't use PayPal, Amazon, wish list, where you can pick up items that we need for our work. All that stuff's there. And that's how you support our work. So please do so. And thanks to everybody out there who has supported us up to this point and lately and everything else. And we appreciate everybody out there and hope that you will continue to support us. All right, A Templar Tower in Rhode Island. A stone structure in Rhode Island has been an unsolved mystery since colonial times. After months of speculating about the possibility of astronomical alignment features with the planet Venus originally built into the Newport Tower, I decided in December 2007 to investigate it myself. The first question came up following 3 years of research into the history of the ideology of certain medieval monks and their kindred military brotherhood, commonly known as the Knights Templar, which the Cisterns created in Cistercians created in 1128 AD. The planet Venus became my focus upon learning that the origin of matriarchal goddess-based religions began with ancient man's reverence of the brightest star in the sky as a female deity. The Cistercians and Templars also revered the sacred feminine, using the Virgin Mary as a metaphor for the ancient goddess. Members of these faith-based military orders understood the sacred historical connection with Venus and used astronomical cycles of the planet in conjunction with geometry and mathematics in a variety of both practical and religious ways. The capturing of astronomical alignments of the Sun, Moon, Venus in Western Europe, standing stone sites, and churches allowed the builders to use these structures as clocks and calendars and for determining longitude using solar and lunar eclipses and latitude. The religious aspect of alignments was primarily associated with the winter and summer solstices and spring and fall equinoxes. Much of the solar and lunar alignments in the Newport Tower have been documented by Professor Emeritus Dr. William Penhallow. His research effectively proved that numerous windows and niches inside the tower were intentionally made to capture various astronomical alignments, but he was apparently unaware of Venus alignments and did not study them. This paper proposes that Venus alignments are captured in the tower providing evidence consistent with medieval Cistercian Templar construction practices that reflect, in part, their religious ideology. On December 19, 2007, I traveled to Newport, Rhode Island to investigate this theory with fellow researcher and friend David Brody. We selected three mornings, December 20th, 21st, and 22nd, that bracket the winter solstice. After making arrangements to gain access to the tower with the City of Newport Parks officials, Susan Cooper and Scott Wheeler, who were most accommodating, we arrived each morning at 4 a.m. just as Venus was rising in the southeastern sky. To our great frustration and disappointment, never once were we able to actually see the planet due to heavy cloud cover. However, we were able to make some important observations. The first observation showed that there is a horizontally oriented rectangular opening in window W6, allowing light from Venus to enter the tower and hit niche N4 as predicted. However, we did not observe an opening in window W7 that will allow light from Venus to hit niche N1 or N2. Future research into Venus alignments by qualified researchers will hopefully provide validation of their existence. The first alignment involves the four-year period in the eight-year cycle when Venus is a morning star in the southeastern sky. Its altitude is approximately 22 degrees, which is the same angle of a line drawn from a square niche on N4. On the west, inside wall up through the small square window near the top of the tower on the southeastern side. The second alignment involves the four-year period in the eight-year cycle when Venus is an evening star in the western northwestern sky. Its altitude is again approximately 22 degrees, which is the same angle of a line drawn from the square niche in two on the east-southeast side. Inside wall up through the small square window near the top of the tower on the western side. When we checked the W7 to N2 alignment, there was not a visible opening to allow Venus to be seen. It is unclear why this is so. However, it is possible that an opening did exist at one time, but however, since has been altered due to repairs of the upper walls. Former Rhode Island Governor William C. Gibbs reportedly told historian Benson J. John Lossing, who was visiting Newport in 1848, roughly between 1775 and 1780, the British used the tower for an ammunition magazine. When they had to evacuate Newport, they tried to destroy the old building by igniting a keg of powder in it. The masonry did not collapse, however, and the only result was the loss of the roof and 2 or 3 feet of the upper stoneworking of the wall. Goddamn Limeys couldn't even blow it up. It is unclear if 2 or 3 feet were lost above the present height of the tower, or if the present top 2 or 3 feet were lost and then repaired. On December 22, 2007, the rays of the rising sun of the winter equinox cast a vertical rectangle that hit directly on the egg-shaped keystone in the west archway between columns P7 and P8. In spite of the heavy overcast weather and our failure to see the planet Venus, the other important objective of our trip was successfully accomplished on that same morning. At 8:15 a.m., we arrived at the tower to record the precession of the rectangular box of sunlight through window W2. Researcher Jim Ian was the first to document this event in 2001 and presented the information at the first ever Newport Tower Symposium on October 27, 2007. He did not, however, offer an interpretation as to what the illumination might represent. The light of the rising sun on the winter solstice shines through the southern window and casts a rectangular box of sunlight that first shines through the west-facing window at approximately 7:45 a.m. As the sun continues rising at an increasing angle to the window, the rectangular box becomes wider and moves downward in a northerly direction from window 3 along the northwestern wall inside the tower. At approximately 9 a.m., the box of sunlight hits squarely on and brightly illuminates the light tan-colored egg-shaped keystone in the west-northwest archway. When personally witnessed, intentional incorporation into the structure by the original builder seems abundantly clear. Following is my interpretation of an explanation for this feature that is consistent with the religious beliefs of the Cistercians and the Templars. The round tower was considered a church nave that represented the womb of the sacred feminine goddess. And as you can see in my 4-minute film preview, the original well where the rock wall was found is shaped in a round. That's what they call it, the watchtower. Boy, I'd love to get my hands on getting that motherfucker excavated again. Especially now reading this, seeing that, you know, that definitely was a part of, because to me, that just goes to prove that it was, I just think if you think rock wall's a natural, if you think it's a natural formation, you're fucking out of your mind. But come on, Mother Nature doesn't make 90-degree angles, folks. Or, you know, 7-story round watchtowers. The egg-shaped keystone on the inside was constructed as the Orphic egg with inside the womb. When the light of the sun, considered a male deity, struck the egg on the winter solstice, it was metaphorically inseminated. The allegorically fertilized embryo inside the womb underwent gestation until it hatched with the birth of the new ideology, goddess worship, along with the new life, spring, in the New Jerusalem. Beginning at 8:15 a.m. on December 22, 2007, a rectangular box of sunlight passing through the window moved progressively with the rising sun downward and north along the west-northwest inner wall of the tower. At roughly 9 a.m., I was able to photograph the rising suns illuminating the egg-shaped keystone on the northwest archway of the Newport Tower. That these celestial orientations were deliberately put into the Rhode Island structure seems certain. If so, they continue to identify its Templar Cistercian architects who incorporated the astronomical symbolism of their heretical spirituality of the Newport Tower decades before Christopher Columbus sailed to the New World. Well, what's interesting about that is that, you know, Quetzalcoatl was said to have he wore like a Templar type cross. That's what I think's interesting. All right, so that's the end of chapter 18. Let me just a second here. I need to. You know, I just have I not made it clear that I'm just somebody that didn't have time to fuck around? You don't get drunk and act stupid and do all that. You just do it somewhere else. I don't have time for it. I'm tired of this shit. Idiots coming in my chat room acting the fool. Give me a second here. Officially handed down the ban hammer. There you go. Indians' 12th century Welsh fortress. When early 19th century portrait painter George Catlin lived with the Mandan Indians of North Dakota for 8 months, he was struck by a number of Welsh words in their spoken language. Ever since, independent investigators have speculated about possibilities for the arrival of medieval Welsh sea rovers in North America, a hypothesis given new support by analysis of an intriguing stone ruin in the Middle West. A lifelong resident of southwestern Indiana, Rick Osmond, blah, 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 I don't need to know his fucking background. Well, skip that. Sometimes they rope you in, make it look like it's not a bio. The year 1968 was a banner year for the recurrent story of Prince Madoc, who supposedly brought or sent Welsh colonists to North America 3 centuries before Christopher Columbus landed in the Americas. As local southern Indiana rumors go, this one, also from that year, is a diehard. Dr. Barry Fell was lecturing at Indiana University regarding his research into epigraphic evidence of ancient Old World visitation and habitation in the New World. His audience consisted primarily of faculty and staff, with only one or two students or other interested parties. Only about a dozen people in all attended. After the lecture, senior members of the audience asked Dr. Fell if he would consider making a side trip to examine an inscription on a cliffside written in a language that none of the Hoosier State academics had been able to identify. That inscription was at Clifty Falls on the mouth of Clifty Creek, where it joins the Ohio River near Madison, Indiana. The gist of what Dr. Fell claimed to have found at that location read, "I, Owen Op Zurinik, in the year of our Lord 1170, did bring to this place." The text goes on to list a number of persons, cows, pigs, arms, tools, and ships. The year 1968 also saw the republication at private expense of a local history of the Falls of the Ohio. The first compiled in 1882, the following passages are excerpted from that compilation. But this tradition of the Delaware does not stand alone, that the prehistoric inhabitants of Kentucky were at some intermediate period overwhelmed by a tide of savage invasion from the north is a point upon which Indian tradition, as far as it goes, is strong and explicit. It is related in a posthumous fragment on Western Antiquities by Reverend John P. Campbell, M.D., which was published in the early part of the present century, that Colonel James Moore of Kentucky was told by an old Indian that the primitive inhabitants of this state had perished in a war of extermination waged against them by the enemy, and that the last great battle was fought at the Falls of the Ohio, and that the Indians succeeded in driving the Aborigines into a small island below the rapids, where the whole lot of them were cut to pieces. That's describing when they ran the giants out. That's what that's describing. These Aborigines, these giants, some of them were nice and gave them culture, and other ones fed on them, so they got sick of it and just killed the motherfuckers, like you do. The Indian further said that this was an undoubted fact, handed down by tradition, and that the colonel would have proofs of it under his eyes as soon as the waters of the Ohio became low. When the waters of the river had fallen, an examination of Sandy Island was made, and a multitude of human bones were discovered. Having been born and raised in southern Indiana, where I've resided all my life, I was familiar with variations of this story repeated many times. History of the Ohio Falls cities and their counties was the first time I encountered the story in print, but I'd always heard more to the tale, and sure enough, it followed immediately in a flea market treasure. There is similar confirmation of this tradition in the statement of General George Rogers Clark. That there was a great burying ground on the northern side of the river, but a short distance below the falls. According to the tradition imparted to the same gentleman by the Indian chief Tobacco, the Battle of Sandy Island decided finally the fall of Kentucky with its ancient inhabitants. When Colonel McKee commanded the Kanawha, he was told by the Indian chief Cornstalk, with whom he had frequent conversations, that Ohio and Kentucky, and Tennessee is also associated with Kentucky in the prehistoric ethnography of Raffinesque, had once been settled by a white people who were familiar with arts of which the Indians knew nothing. That these whites, after a series of bloody contests with the Indians, had been exterminated, and that the old burial places were the graves of an unknown people, and that the old forts had not been built by Indians, but had come down from a very long time ago people who were of a white complexion and skilled in the arts. Here we go! Yep. See, they've known about this forever. This is one of the big cover-ups. Historical investigators from both Washington, D.C. Smithsonian Institution and Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History dated this steel helmet with chail mane accidentally discovered by John Brady in 1898 near Clarksville, Indiana, from 310 to 379 A.D. The history has one further reiteration of the story, but no significant differences appear except this. A differentiation between white Indians and black Indians, as told by an Indian, and that the burial site a short distance down the river from Clarksville was then, in 1780, covered with an alluvial deposition of earth 6 or 7 feet deep. We have at least three accounts of the genocide of a racially separate people that inhabited an area below the river, but the burial ground is either in the river or on an island, or is north of the river, and we have documentation of the Indians' great leaders, Tobacco and Cornstalk. I'm sorry, I know I'm not supposed to laugh, but that's funny. What's your name? How? I'm Tobacco. What's your name? Hi, oh, I'm Cornstalk. Telling the same story with the amount ending in at least three different locations. Sandy Island, Corn Island, in a field down the river from Clarksville. There are pioneer accounts of bone fields being found in each two of those locations. All we can conclude from the various differences is that the story was very old at the time it was retold to white settlers. Who might have been these white Indians? The history also contains a clue, namely, that Mr. Thomas S. Hind, an old citizen of Kentucky, neighbor and companion of Daniel Boone and Simon Keaton, wrote a letter in his old age from his home in Mount Carmel, Illinois, dated May 30th, 1842, to the editor of American Pioneer, in which is related the following startling bit of information. It is a fact that the Welsh, under Owen ap Zurich in the 12th century, found their way to the Mississippi as far up the Ohio as the falls of that river at Louisville, where they were cut off by the Indians. Others ascended the Mississippi and were either captured or settled and sunk into Indian habits. Proof. In 1799, the skeletal remains of 6 soldiers were dug up near Jeffersonville. Each skeleton had a breastplate of brass cast with the Welsh coat of arms. The mermaid and harp with a Latin inscription in substance, virtuous deeds meet their just reward. One of these plates was left by Captain Jonathan Taylor with the late Mr. Hubbard Taylor of Clark County, Kentucky, and when called upon me in 1814 for the late Dr. John P. Campbell, a Chillicothe, Ohio, who was preparing notes of the antiquities of the West by a letter from Hubbard Taylor, Jr., I was informed that the breastplate had been taken to Virginia by a gentleman of that state, I supposed as a matter of curiosity. Mr. Hind continued, "The Mohawk Indians had a tradition among them respecting the Welsh and of their being cut off by the Indians at the falls of the Ohio. The late Colonel Joseph Hamilton Davies, who had for many years sought for information on this subject, mentions this fact, and of the Welshman's bones being found buried on Corn Island, so that Southey, the King's Laureate, had some foundation for his Welsh poem." The editor closed this passage by stating, "The story of the Jeffersonville skeletons, we hardly need add, is purely mythical. It is not probable that any pre-Columbian Welshman was ever at the Falls of Ohio. The rest of the tradition I have heard throughout the past 40 years or so includes the existence of 12 cut stone fortresses spaced one day's march apart, all stretching from all the way across Indiana from Clifty Creek on the Ohio to Merrim Bluff on the Wabash. The compilation book only once includes the one phrase, old forts, offering no further details. There we have the bulk of the unknown evidence on this side of the Atlantic for Welsh having immigrated to what later became Indiana. And most of that evidence is documentation of oral tradition. And that, sadly, is not much to take to any university's history or archaeology department. I knew of several old fort locations before reading the history, including Clifty Creek, a bluff overlooking the Ohio River on the Indiana side, now part of Clifty Creek State Park. According to local lore, all the stones of this fortress were used in the late 19th century to build a railroad trestle over the Ohio. Then there was Merrim Bluff, overlooking the Wabash River. But in an area of controlled access owned by a power utility, a few of the flooring stones of this site are supposed to be still in place, but because I can't access the site easily, I am unable to verify that they do, in fact, exist. The site of another ancient fort is located at Five Points Trail, a.k.a. Saddle Creek Trail, in the Charles C. Dean Wilderness Area. All of the flooring stones and about half the stones of two walls remain intact at this site, according to a reliable witness. All these locations have some governmental or other factor restricting on-the-ground research. Now, isn't that interesting? That goes to show you that I'm just not paranoid, folks. Because, you know, I've found that over and over again. Anytime you find mounds or, you know, any kind of site, there's always some sort of government or official state activity going on that, you know, restricts you from having access to it. And it's not a coincidence or an accident. Consequently, I set out to find one or more of the 12 that might be on real estate I could more easily access. I examined topographic maps and waterway maps and used the idea that a one-day march between the sites means that all of them had been chosen using a defensive mindset. Such a mentality would include as evidence at the previously known places, but the military planners originally wanted at least one side that could not be assaulted and that they therefore would not have to defend. They would also require easy access to water. As such, I needed to find high, steep bluffs overlooking free-flowing rivers or tributaries. Once meeting these criteria in the Lawrence County near Fishing Creek and within a half mile of the East Fork of White River, from here, the 12th century Welshmen surveyed a wild landscape and they dreamed of incorporating in their royal realm, but it was not to be. Like others before and after them, they and their ambitions were swallowed by the immensity and native hostility of prehistoric America. So that's the end of chapter 19. The next chapter is chapter 20, Prehistoric Forts or Observatories. Sounds like that'll probably tie back in with more rock wall stuff, doesn't it? Well, speaking of that, if you have watched my trailer, my preview to the film and the pitch for the possible TV show, if you want to see more of that and you want to help us out to get that film out, theglobalreality.com, we have a chip-in banner there for that, and that's where you can help us. My name is Josh Reeves. I love each and every one of you, and we'll see you next time for the show. You guys have yourselves a great one. Take care.